Hello again, I'm Armin Alnick. Even before the Helsinki meeting of Presidents Trump and Putin, David Corn of Mother Jones had a warning. Much of the political and media elite and the citizenry, he wrote, seemed to be sleepwalking past a horrific and fundamental fact. The current president of the United States has helped to cover up a serious attack on the nation. We'll talk with David Corn in a moment. But how could such a historically unprecedented scenario be anything but a kook theory? Jonathan Chait asked that question in New York Magazine, also before the two presidents met and held their news conference in Helsinki. Chait pointed out that the case against Trump, if there is one, has been delivered in scoop after scoop of discrete nuggets of information. It's been disorienting and difficult to follow. What would it look like, he asked, if it were reassembled into a single narrative? Jonathan Chait, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
A single narrative, but not necessarily a simple narrative. You go all the way back to 1987.
I do, and this is admittedly the most unlikely part of the story, but it's also a significant one that I think has received far too little attention. People say that Donald Trump has had certain beliefs about the international system forever or for 30 years. And sometimes that's a way of explaining his behavior is having nothing to do with Russia. It's just what he believes. But one of the things I wanted to point out here is it's only something he's believed publicly since he went to Russia in 1987. It's pretty well established that Russia was courting him, that he visited Moscow, discussed building something in Moscow, didn't. And shortly after he came back from Moscow, started talking for the first time, A, about running for president, which he hadn't done before, and B, started fiercely attacking American allies for the first time as dead weight freeloaders whom we were protecting without getting any benefit in return.
Let me hold you up for one moment. You say he was courted by Moscow. Vladimir Putin said in Helsinki, no, I didn't even know he was there.
That's right. It's not actually very well known, but this isn't a conspiracy theory. It's a recorded fact. There's photos. No one's denied it. He went to Russia in 1970. He met with the Soviets. Now, that's not proof of guilt. Many people who are not in any way, not only not spies, not influenced, not friendly with the Soviet Union at all, visit Moscow. You know, you can have perfectly innocent reasons to go to Moscow, and in all likelihood, he did. But it's worth considering at least the possibility that someone got to him in some way. Now, maybe something as innocent as just pulling him aside and flattering him and talking up his potential and saying, hey, have you thought about running for president or your country needs you or something as relatively innocent as that. But it was right after this trip to Moscow that he started talking about running for president and started advocating policies that happened to line up very closely with Soviet and Russian foreign policy goals. Now, that's something I think a lot of people don't know. It's worth at least keeping in the back of your mind when you construct this narrative of Trump and Russia, that that's how far back he goes, because Russia has been trying to split apart the Western allies as a primary foreign policy goal. And what Trump started doing after his Moscow trip was exactly that. He started saying, why are we supporting these guys? Why are we protecting them? We're not getting anything out of it. Of course, the answer to his question is we were protecting them from Russia, and in some sense, we still are. That's still an important part of the basis of the policy, and that's what he's doing right now is he's still carrying out these attacks on America's allies and saying they're freeloaders that are giving us anything in return, which perhaps coincidentally and perhaps not is what Russia would like to see an American president do.
Okay, so he went to Moscow in 1987, and it is then that supposedly or reportedly there might or might not have been an incident where he was photographed in a hotel room with prostitutes. You mentioned also that he was talking about putting a building together. What about the financial relationship between not just the president himself and Russian interests, but members of his family as well?
Well, Trump's finances are opaque. Deliberately so, and uniquely for a presidential candidate. But it's pretty clear that at some point it became impossible for him to get loans from standard banks because he doesn't pay people back. He doesn't pay back contractors. He doesn't pay back lenders. That's part of the way he does business, and banks got wise to it.
And he's been bankrupt several times.
Yeah. So he needed to get unconventional sources of money, and a big source of that money was from Russia. Now, Russian money is a little bit curious because it's intertwined with the state. So you have a lot of mafia figures. You have a lot of owners of state-run enterprises. You have a lot of wealthy people, oligarchs in Russia, who have some kind of working relationship with the government. But it doesn't operate like private capital would in the United States, where they're just trying to get the highest rate of return. There's usually a political component to Russian lending, Russian investment. And frequently they dangle lucrative business opportunities in front of their partners, which can be a kind of cover for these partners to accept what are essentially bribes. The Russian economy is pretty crooked. The most profitable elements are monopolies, state-run enterprises, ownership of Russia's many private resources, which basically give a guaranteed right of return to whoever happens to control them. So you can make a business deal with a partner where the deal is essentially no lose, where you can get in on this monopoly, this no lose opportunity. They've done this with partners across the world. They've done it with political figures who Russia's trying to court. This is unfolding right now in Britain, where the person who paid for Brexit, which Russia also supported, was dangled a lucrative gold mining deal that his partner accepted. So that's part of how Russia does business. And from all outside appearances and by the admissions of the Trump sons, Trump was very closely linked to Russia financially and still is.
So you said the president's own finances are uniquely opaque for a president, not just a president, but a presidential candidate. But his family obviously is very much involved. What have they said? What have they admitted to?
They've said that money is pouring in from Russia and Russians constitute a disproportionate share of their investors. There have been discrete investigations of some of Trump's projects. Adam Davidson in The New Yorker wrote about the building of a hotel in Azerbaijan. There was a great story in the Financial Times a week ago about Trump Tower in Toronto. And what these reporters who look closely at these discrete projects find is all kinds of shady, illegal, politically connected money pouring into Trump and Trump's essentially licensing money laundering from Russian figures. Now, there are other possibilities for what this is. It might be just, and I put the word just, you know, in imaginary quotes, just money laundering. It might be just these figures from Russia, you know, using cash to stash their finances overseas with no strings attached, and the only thing they're getting in return is someone who's willing to take dirty money and look the other way. But again, the pattern of Russian finances and investment is usually to intertwine political goals with their dealings.
Okay, so we're putting together a single narrative, to use your term. What other elements are they besides what we have already heard about what the president did or didn't do in 1987 and about the financial relationship?
Well, my story that you're talking about in New York Magazine is 8,000 words, and unfortunately, there's no cheat sheet I can give you that can give it all.
As I said at the outset, it is not a simple narrative. It is a single narrative.
Not a simple narrative, and I like to think that the benefit I give you in the story is that I bring it all together and tell the story and leave open different possibilities. I'm not trying to just jump to the darkest conclusions. I tell you, here's what the worst thing that could happen would be that you're not thinking of, but I don't say this is necessarily what happened. In some cases, it might be. In some cases, it probably is. But in many of these cases, we don't really know what the story is. But it's pretty clear that Russia glommed onto Trump. And then I would say the other major part of the narrative that the story focuses on is the role of Paul Manafort.
Okay, we'll get to Paul Manafort in a moment, if you don't mind. Let me ask you to hold back for a second. Again, we're talking with Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine. I said this was a two-barreled crisis. One is the concern about the president's own involvement, his own interests, and the role that they're playing in his diplomacy. The other has to do with a very concentrated attack on the United States and its electoral system. David Korn, once again, Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones, co-author with Michael Isikoff of Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. David Korn, good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Warren. And I just have to say at the outset that Michael Isikoff and I tried to, you know, present the narrative of the story as we know it up to now, with Trump's history with Russia and with the 2013 Miss Universe contest and his bizarre, the beginnings of his bizarre interactions and sort of love affair with Putin, and what happened in 2016 and how that followed from a strategic plan that Putin and the Kremlin had put in place for years about attacking Western liberal democracies, and then how everything played out during the campaign and afterward. So I'm hoping that, you know, we did provide, now it's a little bit more than 8,000 words that Jonathan wrote, but we, you know, in book form and narrative form, try to make this as straight through and easy to understand as possible.
Okay, so you're both working on this single narrative idea. You mentioned the 2013 Miss Universe pageant. We didn't go into detail about that. We talked about 1987 and his visit then.
Right, and as Jonathan described in his story, as we get into in our book, Trump spent 30 years trying to do business in Russia, and it culminated in the Miss Universe contest in 2013, which led to a deal to build a tower with an oligarch very close to Putin. And then that led again to another deal during the campaign when he was running for president, a secret deal they didn't tell voters about, which he once again tried to build a tower in Moscow. All these events of the recent years could not happen without the approval of the Moscow government. And who's in charge of that? So he, you know, there were two things. He wanted to make money in Moscow, and he also had the psychological affinity for Vladimir Putin that's gone back a couple of years, and that's all sets up what happened in 2016 and what we've even seen in the last week, in which Donald Trump just cannot come to terms, cannot acknowledge that Putin attacked the United States. And you were right to call it. It's a military cyber attack. It's not meddling. Meddling is the, you know, is maybe what you do in your kid's life, you know, when they're teenagers. They call it meddling. But it's a military intelligence attack that's part of a strategic plan that Putin had in place for years. And because of what Jonathan described, because of what we describe in the book, this long love affair with Putin and this desire to do business in Russia and connections that have resulted out of that, Trump, you know, cannot talk about this in any way that is coherent, sensical, or that protects, most importantly, protects U.S. national security interests.
Tell us a little bit about the indictment of the 12 Russians that came out from the investigation 3 days before the president went to Helsinki, and which is described as an effort on the part of the Justice Department to warn him.
Well, I mean, what we've seen and heard in the last couple of days with the indictment and with the president's own remarks, none of that is unknown in the big picture, right? The U.S. intelligence community, even the congressional committees, the intelligence committees that are run by Republicans in the Senate and the House, have all said the attack occurred, have all said it was done in part by the GRU, the military intelligence wing of the Russian apparatus. And what was stunning about the indictment itself was just how specific it was. They had the names of 12 individuals. They had what units they were from. They had dates and times of when they penetrated the Democratic National Committee servers and the email of John Podesta, the campaign chairman for Hillary Clinton. It didn't change the big picture, which is that the attack happened. Now, the fact that this indictment came out 3 days before Trump met with Putin put a lot of pressure on Trump to address this. And when he comes to that press conference earlier this week, he totally botches it because he can't say the words that Russia attacked and that Putin is responsible for this, as the U.S. intelligence community has said. So it put him in a spot. And I think what it led to was nothing that was revelatory, but it was clarifying. You know, the whole world and people who pay attention and people who don't pay attention could see him in this environment, in this context, refusing to accept reality, and more importantly, helping Putin cover up. This is where there is proven collusion. The president keeps saying no collusion, no collusion, but from the campaign and through his presidency, he keeps presenting Russian disinformation that the attack didn't happen or you can't be sure. This is the Russian disinformation line to cover up for the attack, to say we didn't do it. And the president keeps repeating this disinformation. It's you know, it sounds hyperbolic. And you don't want to, like, you know, you want your head to explode when you see people saying this. But the president of the United States has become a disinformation agent for Russia. I mean, you couldn't write the script.
Pretty strong words coming from anybody, and that's certainly true as we hear them on this podcast. Tell us a little bit more about the attack itself, because the indictment goes into great detail about all that was done, the extraordinary amount of money that was spent to do it, the number of people involved in it, the fact that they used websites and actually set up rallies of people, particularly pointing at the African-American community, which was thought to be very important to Hillary Clinton's campaign. This was a big deal.
It was a big deal. And I really encourage people to read the indictment, because it does read like a cyber thriller. They used Bitcoin and blockchain to pass money. There were Americans who they were, you know, who they were in touch with and with servers to get all this going. They penetrated the DNC and they targeted hundreds of Democratic targets with very sophisticated intrusion methods. And, you know, it breaks down to a campaign that had three very different but intertwined components. One was to get information on the person who they didn't want to win, Hillary Clinton or her party or her advisors, and use that, weaponize it to make things more difficult for them. So that was what the DNC emails that came out and the John Podesta emails that came out in October right before, you know, election day. Then they had the social media campaign, which was a little bit more vague in intent and not as focused. It was just to, you know, take existing divisions in our political culture, exploit them, and make them more intense. And, you know, it had a tilt against Hillary in favor of Donald Trump, and set up some rallies for Trump and tried to set up some anti-Clinton rallies through Facebook and Twitter. But that was a sort of a separate branch. And, you know, it's harder to measure that impact. Some of that campaign was very sophisticated. Other parts seemed less so. But they ended up getting people on the Trump campaign to retweet these fake tweets that were put out by Russian trolls. So they really got the Trump campaign itself to advance this effort. And the third thing, which is what scared the White House the most, if we get into this in great depth in Russian roulette, was that they penetrated voting systems in states. You know, most people know that our voting systems are controlled at the state and local level, not nationally. And they got into databases, they got into registration files, they got data on 500,000 voters in Illinois, I believe. And, you know, they didn't, as far as we know, fiddle with anything on election day itself, but demonstrated the ability to do so, to cause chaos and confusion on election day, maybe not actually change vote tallies, but to discredit elections so that the ultimate outcomes might not be accepted.
All right. And the concern about penetrating the voting systems is one of the things that is still hanging over us, because it appears that not a lot is being done about it. I want to go back to Jonathan Chait on a couple of points. First of all, do you agree, or is it too strong to say that the president has become a disinformation agent for Russia?
That's true, but the reverse is true as well. Russia has become a disinformation agent on behalf of Trump. They're working together. I think the debate about collusion has become beside the point. It's not really whether there was collusion, it's how much collusion. They had a joint interest in electing Donald Trump, and they were working together. I think it's very obvious from the known facts that many people, and almost certainly Donald Trump himself in the Trump administration, were aware that Russia was working to help elect him, is probably going to work to help Republicans win in 2018 and again in 2020. It's an alliance. And I suppose the most banal way to look at it is that Russia is like a super PAC that's supporting Trump, just like the National Rifle Association or any other member of the coalition, the difference being that they're not American and they can't legally impact the election. But the enforcement of these laws is pretty weak. And I think Trump is at minimum, happy to take advantage of.
Earlier, I said I'd give you a chance to talk about Paul Manafort, whom you mentioned. And here's a man who was working in Ukraine on behalf of pro-Russian candidates there. He disappeared, as I understand it, for some period of time, and then suddenly reappeared as Donald Trump's campaign manager. Tell us about him and what's happening right now. He's looking at a courtroom, and a hearing is scheduled very soon.
Right. Well, to pull back for a moment, I think the thing that people who are skeptical of some deep tie between Trump and Russia need to understand is that this is completely standard operating procedure for Russia in modern life. Putin finds right-wing political allies in Western countries and supports them covertly and overtly, sometimes with payments, sometimes with social media attacks or other ways. He does this in country after country after country. It's not a surprise. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's well established. One of the countries he did this in was Ukraine, where Russia was supporting the pro-Russian party, attacking the mainstream party as corrupt and untrustworthy and exploiting cultural splits and encouraging the election of a government that would be friendlier to Russia. The person who ran this campaign in Ukraine was Paul Manafort. And then after doing this, Paul Manafort disappeared, and then the Russian oligarch he was working for told the court that we can't find the guy, and then he basically pops back up on the surface as Trump's campaign manager. He then sent emails to his business partner, who was a Russian operative, basically saying, how can we use my work for the campaign to get whole, that is, to basically repay my debt to this Russian oligarch? So it's known that basically the guy who was running a covert Russian political influence operation in Ukraine then ran the Trump campaign. And I think the best way to think about this is basically it's analogous activities. He seems to have been doing in the United States the same thing he did in Ukraine.
So now we have, he's been charged with the various financial crimes here in this country. And now five witnesses want to testify under immunity from the Fifth Amendment, if the judge is going to allow them to do that. What do you anticipate, or is it possible?
You know, it's a really mysterious situation, because I think by the logic of self-interest, Manafort should have already cracked and agreed to cooperate with Robert Mueller. It is true that he can anticipate being pardoned by Donald Trump, who's basically indicating that he's willing to pardon everyone if they keep their mouths shut. He's like a mob boss, but with pardon power in this respect. But that's not going to help Manafort, because there are state crimes that he can be charged with, and the federal government can't affect those, and Donald Trump can't pardon those. So Manafort is going to go to prison if he doesn't cooperate with Robert Mueller. If he doesn't just go for federal charges, he'll go for state charges in Virginia and New York, both of which are looking after him and where he's vulnerable. So the real question I raise in my piece is, why isn't he cooperating already with Robert Mueller?
Let me go back to David Korn and ask you about yet another figure, Maria Butina, whose name has just appeared relatively recently, a Russian woman, 29 years old, who came here to get a graduate degree, which she did at American University. She also worked with the National Rifle Association very closely, apparently. She is a pro-gun person. Doesn't mean much in Russia, but it means a lot here. And she has some kind of connection to the Republican Party as well. She has now been arrested. Tell us more about the background of that.
Well, this isn't a crazy story. We get into this in our book, Russian Roulette. Maria Butina and her partner, a guy named Alexander Torshin, who is a deputy of the Central Bank of Russia, a senior official in Putin's own political party, and a guy who was even investigated by a Spanish special counsel, special prosecutor, for possible involvement in money laundering linked to organized crime. The two of them, for, I don't know, the past 6 or 7 years, have been appearing at conservative events here in the United States, mainly things related to the National Rifle Association or the Conservative Political Action Committee, but other things as well, and making inroads and making friends and alliances with leading conservatives in these groups. And it was all clear to those of us who reported this in the past and in the indictment that has come out since, that the aim was for them to gain influence with actual Republican leaders, use these groups that are very close to the Republican Party to make contacts to Republican officials, and to do it to advance, you know, Russian interests, and to do it, as the prosecutors now charge, covertly. They have named Maria Butina essentially as a spy who was working with Russian intelligence officials as throughout this operation. And during the campaign, they tried to use their connections with the NRA to set up a meeting between Trump and Putin and to create a back channel between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. It's, it's a little bit like the Americans, or like the case that that led to the Americans cable TV show about sleeper agents. This pair of a young, tall Russian woman and an old, you know, much older, balding Russian official, has led to comparisons to like Boris and Natasha from the Rocky and Bullwinkle comics. They seem to be kind of a comic pair, but they got pretty far. They got well-known conservative activists, people in the NRA and at this group called CPAC, to go visit Russia. They got John Bolton to make a video, you know, extolling gun rights, which don't exist in Russia. So they made connections.
John Bolton, that's an interesting connection, because John Bolton, of course, is the president's national security advisor. Now, is that the only connection between her, Maria Butina, and Trump?
I'm glad you asked. No, there was this bizarre event that happened shortly after Trump announced he was running for president in 2015. He went to one of these conferences called Freedom Fest in Las Vegas that's run by more or less by evangelical groups. And he took, you know, he spoke as a candidate, took some questions. The first questioner who stood up and got asked the question was Maria Butina. And she was acting as if she was a reporter. And she asked Trump, you know, what his position was on the sanctions that the U.S. government had imposed on Russia for annexing Crimea and invading portions of eastern Ukraine. And he went on, and it was kind of, for Trump, a pretty coherent answer about why he thought sanctions were bad, and they got between, you know, they sort of impeded relations between the United States and Russia, and more or less suggested that he would work to get rid of them if he were to become president. The interesting thing is that later on, top Trump aides in the campaign saw a video of this exchange, and it freaked them out. Like, they thought it looked like a setup. Like Maria Butina knew she'd get called on, Trump knew the question was coming, and it was all orchestrated to get an American presidential candidate to come out against the sanctions on Russia. And that had them worried at that time, long before she was indicted.
Okay, we've tried to put together at least a part of the single narrative, to use Jonathan Chait's term, when we began. And Jonathan, you pointed out that in your story that this has come out in the dribs and drabs and in large quantities, as it did in the book by David Korn and Michael Isikoff. What about the mainstream media, which the president accuses so often of fake news? And have the media, do you think, served the public well?
I want to just make sure that it's clear by the construction of your question that I'm in no way impugning the fantastic work that David and other reporters have done on this, in the story, bringing all kinds of facts to light, and I rely on their reporting. I think the reporting has been terrific. I don't really fault the way the mainstream media has gone about this. They found an enormous amount of information. And some, like David, have told narratives based on this information. What I tried to do was a kind of meta-narrative, putting together all the information we know and saying, where could it be leading? What does this tell us about the parts of the story that we don't know, which everyone acknowledges are still out there? We don't really know how far it goes, how close we are to the truth. So that was kind of the thought exercise I tried to do with Mike.
To what extent do you think, David Korn, that reporters are intimidated by the president and by his claim of fake news? And to what extent does Fox News provide a kind of buffer between Trump and the mainstream media?
Well, I think those are two distinct questions. Let me go to the first one first and say that I don't think people are intimidated. I think that what we've seen, and I've written about this as well as Jonathan, is that the way the coverage of this scandal has been, it's come out in sort of spurts and bursts and not chronologically, not linearly. So people hear about a Trump Tower meeting. Then they hear about a meeting in Seychelles. Then they hear about, you know, a Trump financial connection. Then they hear that Jared Kushner met with a Russian banker. And it's incredibly hard, you know, when we're, I think everybody every day is sort of met with 17 different fire hoses of information on this story and other stories as well. And it's very hard to keep the big picture in mind. It's particularly when Trump, and I'll bring in Fox News here, and his enablers on Capitol Hill, mainly Republicans, keep trying to distract from the big picture. They talk about, you know, unmasking. They talk about Trump's wild claim that Obama wiretapped him. They make a big deal over Peter Strzok and his text messages, the FBI official who worked on the investigation. They claim that there have been improper filings of surveillance warrants. They talk about everything other than the main thing. The main thing being that Russia attacked the United States and that the Trump campaign had multiple contacts with Russia while it was happening. And in my mind, most important of all, kept denying it was happening, even after Trump had been told by U.S. intelligence in the summer of 2016 that this attack was underway. So, you know, it's hard for the media to keep coming back and reminding people of these big, you know, the twin poles of the narrative here, when, you know, Trump is out there tweeting away about servers, Pakistani guys who have something to do with emails, and just making things up and throwing out phony, false conspiracy theories and narratives, which are amplified and given legitimacy on Fox News. And the goal is, I think, on his part, is just muddy the waters. And it's hard every day for the responsible media to cut through that and provide the appropriate context.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that for the moment. David Korn, again, is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, co-author with Michael Isikoff of Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. Jonathan Chait is with New York Magazine. He's done a very extensive piece, as we indicated earlier, trying to put together into a single narrative the issues that appear to make President Trump vulnerable in the ways that we have heard them discuss. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. It's been very helpful. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So, has President Trump committed, is he still committing, impeachable offenses? Is he endangering the security of the United States and the rest of the world? More on that in a moment as this To The Point podcast continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. After Helsinki, the criticism of President Trump's performance was deafening. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sent a message to America's European allies.
So make no mistake about it, I would say to our friends in Europe, we understand the Russian threat. And I think that is the widespread view here in the United States Senate among members of both parties.
Back in Washington, the president tried to repair the damage with a clumsy effort to change the wording of his remarks in Helsinki, but he got himself in still more trouble.
And I have felt very strongly that while Russia's actions had no impact at all on the outcome of the election, let me be totally clear in saying that, and I've said this many times, I accept our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia's meddling in the 2016 election took place. Could be other people also.
U.S. intelligence agencies are unanimous that there are no other people, to use the president's phrase, and the president's public questioning of their findings is part of what some are describing as treasonous conduct. One of those is Richard Painter. He's professor of law at the University of Minnesota, and he was ethics advisor in the White House when George W. Bush was president. Professor Painter, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
You have called for impeachment of President Trump. Tell us why.
Well, there are a range of different reasons. His continuing violation of the emolument clause of the Constitution prohibiting profits and benefits from foreign countries, his infringement of the free exercise of religion in his policies toward Muslims, his infringement of the freedom of the press, and his constant tirades against the press and putting those together with actions, his fire of the FBI director, engaging in obstruction of justice. The list of illegal conduct goes on and on. This situation with Russia is very dangerous for the United States. We don't want a nuclear war with Russia. We don't want any war with Russia. And yet Russia has, for a very long period of time, about 100 years, going back to the Communist Revolution, 1917, they've been trying to undermine Western democracies, including the United States. We need to keep in mind they've had a great deal of success in many parts of the world during the communist era. They never made much headway here because we don't have that much of a left wing that's really able, that they were able to organize. But once they discover the right wing of American politics and the right part, those, the Ku Klux Klan and the rest of them, you know, they really have hit pay dirt here. And same old pattern of Russian interference in Western democracies. And we have intelligence services here that have found out what happened. They certainly should have gotten on this a lot sooner in 2016. But here the President of the United States is undermining our own intelligence services. He's describing the European Union as a foe. I mean, the European Union, they've been our allies since since the end of World War II. This is just amazing what's going on. And more Republicans at Capitol Hill are shaking their heads and thinking, gee, this is just not right. So, yes, it's time to investigate, do what we did in 1973 with Nixon. It's a lot worse than Nixon. I mean, Nixon didn't have the KGB doing the Watergate job or whatever. But we need to get going on hearings in the House and Senate Judiciary Committee. Just like we did in 1973-74.
Earlier, we heard David Korn of Mother Jones magazine, that's a fairly liberal publication, say that President Trump has become a disinformation agent on behalf of Russia. Is that too strong a term?
Well, he's certainly a disinformation source on behalf of himself more than anybody else. And if he thinks Russia is going to serve his purposes, he obviously has reasons to appreciate what Russia did in interfering in the 2016 election. They interfered to help him win the presidency. He may have other ties to Russia. This is why we need to investigate his sources of financing and what else is going on. But, President Trump has been a source of disinformation for years, back when he was selling casino bonds for the Taj Mahal. And then, more recently, his rumors he was stirring up about President Obama's birth certificate, which was just complete and utter nonsense and also racist. Disinformation has been his trait for a very, very long time.
What about collusion? He says again and again, without any kind of prompting, that there is no collusion. He says it whenever he gets the opportunity to. David Korn once again said he thinks collusion has been proven. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I think there's undoubtedly this collusion. Now, what Robert Mueller's got to find out is whether it was illegal collusion or whether he's only going to be able to nail people for lying about it. There's collusion. I mean, what was going on in the Trump Tower when they were promising dirt on Hillary? That was obviously collusion. Now, whether the collusion is illegal would turn on what role the Trump campaign had in the either the computer hacking or dissemination of stolen emails that they knew were stolen. So we have yet to see with respect to criminal collusion. Now, once again, though, the president can be impeached and removed for high crimes and misdemeanors as defined by Congress. And Congress has that power. And we got to remember a president was impeached, not convicted, but impeached for lying under oath about his sexual affairs. President Clinton was never criminally charged with anything. So this is up for Congress to decide. But I have to say, this is a very dangerous situation. We have disinformation from the president of the United States, and it concerns a country that has been a longstanding adversary of the United States.
I understand you're a candidate for the Senate in Minnesota. I take it you're running as a Republican.
No. I had to say goodbye to the Republican Party. It just isn't working. They expect full and complete loyalty to Donald Trump. And unfortunately, the extremist elements of the religious right, these anti-abortion crusaders, who really represent a smaller and smaller portion of our society, the Breitbart News crowd, the rest of them have really taken over the party. And it's really quite tragic because I, for a long time, identified with a moderate wing of the Republican Party. People like Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York. I mean, we've had many great Republicans. Former Governor Arne Carlson of Minnesota, who supports my campaign. But I've entered the primary for the Democratic former Labor Party here in Minnesota because that's the only option.
Okay. Thank you for that. I know you may need to leave us in a few moments. Maybe you can stick around a little bit longer. I want to introduce a couple of other people, and hopefully you'll be with us as long as you can. Evan McMullen is next up. He's a former CIA operative, former member of the Republican Party as well, ran as an independent presidential candidate in 2016 to provide an alternative to President Trump. And Evan McMullen, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
We just heard from Richard Painter that a lot of Republicans are very unhappy with President Trump, but they don't want to speak out. Very few have been willing to do so. How do you feel? How strongly do you feel about impeachment?
Well, I think it will be necessary to impeach the president. I think he has already demonstrated that he needs it or that he deserves it, and the country requires it. But I would also like to see more from Mueller before that action happens. And the reason for that is that a strong majority of the country needs to understand that that process, when it takes place, was not a partisan process, was not a partisan action, but was an action of the representatives of the American people, a nonpartisan action to protect the country. If it doesn't play out that way, I fear we're in for great division, even more so than what we already have. But I do believe the president has demonstrated, has earned impeachment already, and it will be necessary to impeach him. But again, I'd like to see where the investigation goes and like to see that information made public before that action's taken as of now.
One of the insider poop sheets that we have on the internet, Mike Allen and Axios, is saying almost every elected Republican we talk to privately thinks President Trump's warm embrace of Vladimir Putin was unexplainable, unacceptable, and un-America. They wish they could say this publicly, but they won't. Do you agree that that's the case, that they want to, but they won't? And is it, as Mike Allen claims, because they are fearful of the fact that the president is more popular with Republicans than they are?
Yeah, I think that is a driving factor. The president remains very popular with the Republican base, although I am curious to see how this Helsinki meeting with Putin and the aftermath will affect those poll numbers. I don't expect them to make the president unpopular with the party, but I expect and hope that at least a few percentage points of his support within the party will dissipate. But we'll see what happens. But the reality is that, yes, Republican members of Congress remain fearful that if they stand up to the president directly, that especially House members in this election season, they'll be removed from office, and those senators who are up for re-election in this season. And so, yes, that is an issue. But I would also add that I sincerely believe that most of our leaders in Congress, certainly the Republicans in Congress, most of them have demonstrated that they do not fully understand the nature of this threat. I believe many do and are cynically downplaying it to protect themselves and to avoid the necessity to take action. But I also believe that leaders like Paul Ryan and even Mitch McConnell, I'm sorry to say, do not are not prepared for this moment in history. They are not prepared to protect the country. They have not been quick to understand this threat. They still don't fully understand it, and they're unwilling for these factors to do much about it.
Richard Painter, back to you. You're running with the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota. Is that the only way to go, or are there around the country some Republicans who are running in what I guess we could describe as what used to be the Republican philosophy, if that's the right term, or Republican understanding, that, in fact, Russia is a dangerous enemy and needs to be confronted?
You're absolutely right. It all depends on the candidate and the race. The problem right now is that the Republican Party apparatus is under the control of Donald Trump. So anybody who opposes him, no matter how conservative, is going to have a lot of trouble. And that's why Senators Corker and Flake aren't running again for office. I think will dissipate. President Trump may not be in office very much longer. He's really showing that he doesn't want to be a president of the United States. I think he probably prefers Vladimir Putin's job. But so I think there definitely are people in the Republican Party who want to wait it out and do the best they can with this. But the problem is the cost may be not standing up to Donald Trump. I think that's too high a price to pay. So I found, at least in Minnesota, that running the Republican Party in this atmosphere would be unworkable. And given the fact that I certainly have more moderate views on a range of issues, particularly the social issues, and I have a very practical approach to government, that's not what's particularly welcome right now, where the ideological emphasis is on things like abortion and standing up for the NRA and things like that, that I just I don't think really are where that those issues are what the voters really care about.
Okay, you mentioned Senators Corker and Flake, two Republicans, one from Tennessee, one from Arizona, resigning from office apparently because they didn't want to run for reelection with Mr. Trump still in the White House. Richard Painter, again, formerly with the George W. Bush White House ethics advisor there, now running as a Democrat farmer labor policy, a Democrat farmer labor party candidate for the U.S. Senate from Minnesota. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So what does America's current political crisis mean for the rest of the world? President Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, has not been directly critical. But after the Helsinki summit, he delivered a speech in South Africa in honor of that country's former leader, Nelson Mandela.
I am not being alarmist. I am simply stating the facts. Look around. Strongman politics are ascendant suddenly, whereby elections and some pretense of democracy are maintained, the form of it, but those in power seek to undermine every institution or norm that gives democracy meaning.
Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He's author of the new book, out in October, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
What do you say to what we just heard from President Obama? Is his a voice that we should hear more from?
I wish we could. I mean, I think the speech he gave was typically eloquent, as Obama often is, but also was candid in pointing to the political trends that are taking place around the world, and I think trends that the United States is now unwittingly supporting, perhaps more wittingly. We've done some things in the past, even before Trump, that in fact I think discredited our own democracy in various ways. But that trend has clearly accelerated under this president.
What did we do in the past, and were some of the things we did under the presidency of Barack Obama?
Well, for example, the United States was very enthusiastic about trying to spread its own values in lots of places, including with the use of military force, as we did in Iraq, as we tried to do in Libya, as we've done in a number of other places. And none of those experiments worked out particularly well for a variety of different reasons. Not only was that costly to us, but also was very costly to those societies, and to some degree discredited the idea that the United States stood for a particular set of values. So again, with the best of intentions, we may have undermined our own cause. And that also helped open the door for someone like Trump, who came in being deeply critical of what the past foreign policy establishment had done.
What do you think is the immediate consequence with regard to the European Union? We heard earlier in the program Senator McConnell trying to reach out, send a message to our European allies, who, of course, have been our allies since World War II, including Germany.
Well, this is a quite interesting situation where many elements of the foreign policy establishment or the existing government institutions are still very strongly supportive of NATO, of the European Union in general. But the president is clearly not, has no real enthusiasm, referred to the EU as a foe, I think largely in terms of in economic terms as well. So you have a situation where many people inside the government are trying to hold these institutions together, while the president is attempting to weaken them, if not destroy them. And unfortunately, in this case, the president's voice is a loud one. It's one that foreign leaders have to pay attention to. And despite repeated efforts on behalf of a number of European leaders to reach out to him, to try and work with him, to try and accommodate or mollify him in various ways, that doesn't seem to be working particularly well. And if this trend continues, I think you could see both a rupture in America's relations with a number of longstanding allies, but equally damaging the United States, in a sense, forcing those countries to start making other arrangements, start looking for more reliable partners. Just today it was announced that the EU and Japan had reached the largest trade deal in their history. So at a moment where the United States under Donald Trump is starting trade wars with lots of other countries, those countries are now starting to make trade deals with each other. This is ultimately not in America's interest or in anybody else's interest. And I think Mitch McConnell, who hasn't done very much to distance himself from the president, in this case, was trying to cut at least slightly against that trend.
Still with us, Evan McMullen, again, a former CIA operative, a former member of the Republican Party, ran as an independent presidential candidate in 2016 to distinguish himself and the party from Donald Trump, which he failed to do. How much of a problem is it for intelligence agencies if, as we just heard, the President of the United States and some of the very important institutions of government, the Congress, the State Department, and others that deal with foreign affairs, appear to be operating on different wavelengths?
Well, most importantly, it costs the American people. And I think it causes breakdowns in two places, chiefly. One place is that we now are in a situation where and have been for a while, actually, in which our top allies do not trust the president. They don't trust his judgment, and they don't trust his allegiances. And as a result of that, they are less likely to share their most sensitive and important information with our intelligence services, which our intelligence services rely upon, because as good as we are, we benefit from the help of our friends, and we help them as well. And those relationships and those intelligence sharing relationships specifically are of great value. But again, because of this trust issue with the president, that information flow has changed, and it is not what it used to be. The second breakdown I would point to would come especially after this Helsinki summit with Putin, but I think this was still an issue beforehand, which is that our own intelligence services have to think twice about the information they share with the president. because, again, the president's judgment and allegiances cannot be trusted. And that is something that I understand it sounds very extreme, and it is very dire, but it is nonetheless the situation in which we find ourselves. And the cost to the American people is a president who is unwilling, I would say unprepared, but I don't think that suffices. I think it's more unwilling and disinterested in serving the American interest. And he is not only unwilling and disinterested, but also lacks the information he would need to exercise the authorities that only he has to protect the country. So we are at a moment now in which we are less secure, less protected than we would otherwise be with our allies working closely with us first in our shared security interests, with our intelligence organizations working closely with the president offering his best judgment and using his authorities to protect the country based on that information. And again, his judgment, that's the way it should work. That is not the way it is working now due to those breakdowns. And we are vulnerable as a result.
Stephen Walt, back again to you, Professor of International Affairs at the Kennedy School. We hear again and again on this program and in the media as well that we have a president who seems to be operating on interests, according to interests of his own, that are different from and in some ways contradictory to those of the United States. Is there any mechanism that we have for coping with that, or is impeachment the only thing? Is the only does the only possible redress lie with Congress?
Well, I think that that's a road we hope we don't go down. I agree with what was said earlier in the program about wanting to see what Mr. Mueller actually comes up with, and not having a sort of rush to judgment. That's why, in my view, it's unwise to start throwing around words like treason, which is a very serious charge, until we really have more evidence. I think, in fact, impeachment, if it comes to that, is going to be deeply divisive for this country. Those who support Trump now are going to believe that he's been railroaded. They will believe various conspiracy theory notions about a deep state that was out to get him from the very beginning. And unless there is absolutely crystal clear sort of smoking gun evidence of genuine treason or active illegal collusion, I think an impeachment solution here could be as damaging as the Trump presidency has already been. So, for me, the ideal outcome here is that Trump begins to recognize that he has gone badly off course and then is removed from office at the next election by the American people. That one, I think, would be the best outcome here for the country. And if impeachment turns out to be our only recourse, that's going to have real repercussions down the road as well, even if it eliminated a president who is clearly out of his depth and has no real idea what he's doing at this point.
In the meantime, we have the Mueller investigation, and very soon, very possibly, a trial of Paul Manafort. And earlier in the program, we heard about what's at stake in that incident. There are others as well, of course, including the indictments against the Russian military people who will probably never be tried because they're not in this country. But we also have this young woman who has been arrested and is also likely to be tried. What do you think will be the outcomes of those things? The Manafort one may, in fact, be resolved before the end of this year or in before the elections.
Well, I think it's a mistake to try and forecast the results of any of these things. These are criminal investigations, and eventually, if they go to trial, evidence will be presented, and we will all know more about exactly what Mueller has found and exactly what the facts are. And to say that we know that X or Y is guilty or innocent or whatever, I think, is a mistake. We should judge that once all of those facts are known. I do think, however, that those who are calling, for Mueller to wrap things up, and that this is going on too long, and that suggesting that the whole thing is politically motivated, it seems to me are doing the country an enormous disservice. I think it is very important that the American people have a clear understanding of what did or did not happen in the past, what the relationship between the Trump organization and the Trump campaign and any foreign powers, including Russia, may or may not have been. And the only way to be confident that we really know about that is to allow this investigation to proceed to a logical conclusion and then, you know, make our own collective judgment. So, again, anybody who wants to short-circuit that process at this point, I think, is doing us all a disservice.
Evan McMullen, back to you. Do you agree that we really need to wait, not get ahead of ourselves, hopefully that the electoral process will, in fact, end up removing the president rather than having to go through impeachment?
I somewhat agree with that. I have, I think, a slightly different view in that I believe, and I think it is true based on what our intelligence services are saying in the public, that our country remains under threat. We continue to be attacked. The core of our democracy, the core of our system of self-rule is being attacked. And so I worry a little bit that if we wait too much longer, for example, 2020, that those attacks could become so sophisticated and our polarization so stark that we may face challenges in that mechanism, that is our presidential elections in 2020. I'm concerned about that. I do think that it would be ideal, yes, without those circumstances, it would be ideal for the American people simply to choose another president, to rebuke Trumpism and Trump, and to choose someone else, whether it be a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, but somebody who's committed to the foundational values of our country, to our system of self-rule, our democracy, and to the alliances that that protect us, that help keep us safe. But I just don't know that we'll have that luxury. And if Mueller releases information that demonstrates wrongdoing by the president, that demonstrates his collaboration with the very foreign adversary that continues to attack our democracy, well, then I think action on that timetable will be necessary before 2020.
Professor Walt, Martha Roby, a woman running as an anti-Trump Republican candidate for Congress in Alabama, has recently won the Republican primary. Do you view that as a positive development?
Well, yes, it's a positive development, but it's a very small step. You know, as was said earlier, he remains remarkably popular among the Republican Party. The last public opinion polls I saw suggested that his approval rating among registered Republicans was, you know, in excess of 90%, which is almost historically unprecedented. I do think that reflects some of the ways that the party has evolved. You may not know this, but in fact, today you've had a trio of former Republicans on your show. Although I left the party before Trump showed up. So in any case, yes, it's a positive sign. But unless more people in the party begin to believe that the Republican Party itself is going to be harmed by their association with this president, and we may see that, of course, after the midterms in November, if in fact Republicans do very badly in that, if the House or the Senate, or less likely both, flip to Democratic control, that's not only going to change the politics inside Washington, but it's also going to be a real warning sign to the Republican Party that they are associated with a toxic product here, and that they need to distance themselves in some very real ways from him.
Let's just—I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to let you and our listeners hear one more comment from President Trump, who says that he's trying to find common ground with Russia, and that's part of his job.
Getting along with Russia would be a good thing. Getting along with China would be a good thing. Not a bad thing, a good thing. In fact, a very good thing. We're nuclear powers, great nuclear powers. Russia and us have 90% of the nuclear weapons. So I've always felt getting along is a positive thing, and not just for that reason.
Stephen Walt, what's wrong with that?
there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. He's correct to say that we should try to improve our relationship with Russia. And I even think he was correct in saying that the United States bears some degree of responsibility for the deterioration, not all of the responsibility, but some of it. But you can believe both of those things and still want to protect American interests in a variety of different places, live up to the commitments we've made to other countries, and in particular, be opposed to possible Russian interference in our electoral processes. There's nothing inconsistent with wanting to have a good relationship with Russia and wanting to defend American democracy. And if Mr. Trump had been smart, he would have first lined up Allied support when he went to NATO headquarters, gotten NATO unified behind him, and then gone to see Mr. Putin from a position of strength and said, look, we've got to talk about this issue here. Here's what my intelligence services tell me. I completely believe that they're right, and you've got to stop it. And if you don't, the following consequences are going to happen to you. There's nothing inconsistent between negotiating with Russia, trying to improve the relationship, and defending U.S. interests. But I'm afraid the president either doesn't understand that or has been unwilling to go down that road.
2 hours together behind closed doors. Do you think that there will be conspiracy theories coming out of that as a result of the fact that nobody knows what they did? Do you think that there's any chance that the Congress, one of the committees of Congress, will try to subpoena and question the translator?
Well, we had people starting to suggest conspiratorial inferences even before the meeting took place, once the ground rules were announced. And several people in Congress have already said they'd like to interview the translators to find out what went wrong. But given that Republicans control the key committees, it's not obvious that they're going to be able to get those subpoenas issued or not. So that may have been more political posturing. It's certainly not reassuring. And it is one of these things that, to me, I find rather baffling. I mean, here is a president who has been accused, whether rightly or wrongly, of colluding with Russia in the campaign or possibly afterwards, who's trying to convince us that he is not, in fact, Putin's puppet. And then he arranges a meeting in precisely the fashion that's going to magnify concerns and magnify suspicions, and then, to top it all off, goes and stages this bizarre press conference where he appears to agree with Putin more than he agrees with our own intelligence services. It is kind of baffling behavior given what you would think Trump's own interests would be, namely to allay those concerns rather than fuel them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on our podcast. And let me just point out to our listeners that things are happening thick and fast, and we may or may not have caught up with all of them. Probably not. And it may well be that new things have developed by the time you hear this, but I think we've gotten a great deal of good background from our guests. And I want to thank Stephen Walt at the Kennedy School, author of a new book coming out soon, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of the U.S. Primacy, and Evan McMullen, a former CIA operative, former Republican, as all of our last three guests have been, ran as an independent presidential candidate in 2016. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you. To you, Warren.
The producer of today's To the Point podcast, Andrea Brody. Our engineers are Joel Stein and Chuck Previtari. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point wherever you get your podcasts. And if you get them from Apple Podcasts, leave a message there for other listeners. Let us know what you hear when you turn to The Point. Join us again.